Spirit Radio Podcasts. The best of the morning show on Spirit Radio.
Kilkenny farmer Stephen O'Reilly came to studio to talk about regenerative farming. And while he was here, he took the time to take the Life in Five challenge, where our guests share about their life and faith by answering five questions that they choose from a shortlist. Here is Stephen O'Reilly talking to Spirit Radio's Rob Clark.
So, Stephen, let me put a few questions to you. Here's one you've chosen. A favourite Bible verse and why?
Okay, so I'd have to pick Isaiah chapter 40, verse 28 to 31. I'll just read it out. It's basically, do you not know? Have you not heard? The Lord is your everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He will not grow tired or weary, and his understanding no one can fathom. He gives strength to the weary and increases the power to the weak. Even youths grow tired and weary, and young men stumble and fall. But those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint.
Stephen, I can imagine that this verse speaks to you, because I can imagine a farmer feels weary at times.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, and I've had a few challenging years, certainly of late. My mother, she's going through cancer treatment at the moment, and we were only speaking about this verse, and then she sent it to me as well, and I just felt it really spoke to me, and it is certainly one you lean on when times are tough in the depths of winter.
Yeah.
And to remember that you have to hand it to the Lord.
Yeah.
You know,
and I mean, on a farm, there's jobs that have to be done.
Yeah.
Rain, hail or snow.
That's it.
You can't ring the boss and say, look, I can't make it in today.
No, you are the boss. And there's no one else to turn to.
There's no one else.
Yeah.
You got a second. How does God help you in your work?
Well, I suppose I thought about this one, and really, I'm fairly stubborn, and I don't lean on the Lord enough, it's fair to say. And I think regarding the very nature of farming, you really are out of the control of the elements. The Lord is in full control, and it's in that very aspect of it that he teaches you patience, which I badly do need. I've been working on it years, but still I find myself stumbling, and this is where I find he comes in. So from that regard, that's where I find it. That's where he helps me with my work.
Yeah, very good. Okay, a time, where you've seen a miracle.
Well, I'm the father of two boys, and both were miracles, but when we my wife had home births, so that's kind of what she really wanted when giving birth. So we the two boys were born at home, when Jacob was born, the second, the youngest, I delivered him.
Okay.
So that was an incredible miracle.
That was.
Yeah. You don't get much more. And,
no.
I didn't need a Cabin Jack. It was unbelievable. And the whole room, the lead up to it, the whole room had just completely and utterly changed. It was the presence of Christ was just unbelievable. It was like a light switch when it actually, because she had gone to the bathroom. I helped her to the bathroom. We came back to the bedroom, and when we walked into the room, it was just even just before it was really going to kick off. Yeah. There was such a feeling of a total change in the atmosphere.
God's presence.
Yeah, it was just it was immense. Yeah, it really was. So that was a miracle.
And there, that little baby holding in your hands, those first precious seconds and new life.
Unbelievable.
Wonderful. Where you see God in everyday life?
Well, farming is pretty much my life, so I kind of always stem back to it. And where I see the Lord is when I'm on the land, whether it be winter or summer. But if I hear a woodpecker, or if I hear a new calf that's been born bawling for its mother, or if I see frost and ice on the coat of a cow, I think for it all, it just brings me back to knowing that, there's an awful lot going on here bigger than me, and it's all for the glory of him. Even the ball of the calf looking for its mother, or the buzzard in the sky above me, it's all for the glory of him, and that's where I see it.
Yeah, fantastic. A favourite piece of music and why?
Okay, so that would have to be cowboy singer in the States called Jesse Ballantyne. And his song that sticks out for me is Joy in the Journey. And really, it's agricultural based because he's a working cowboy himself. But really, I can read a few lines for you, Rob. It's basically the last few lines of one of the sections of the song. Cattle on the hillside, valley down below, peace like a river is winding through my soul. I may not make much money, but I'm wealthy just the same, because freedom is my treasure and the good Lord knows my name. This is the day the Lord has made, and I stand in awe of his way. I thank him for this life, for my children and my wife, the joy in the journey.
Fantastic. What a beautiful, beautiful song, beautiful words, and you could almost say written for a farmer.
It really is. There is one thing in the States with ranching. They give a lot, they really do know who the Lord is because they're out in it, and they know how small they are in comparison to it all. So they depend on him quite a bit, and that's where I get my inspiration from as well.
The Best of the Morning Show.
The current leadership race in the UK's Conservative Party has thrown up plenty of juicy details about candidates' personal lives. I talked to Patricia Casey, consultant psychiatrist at the Mater Hospital in Dublin and emeritus professor of psychiatry at UCD, about our appetite for information about the personal lives of public figures and whether this is a healthy approach. First, I asked Patricia, who was attending a conference in London, if the Tory leadership race was a big topic of conversation.
It is a huge topic of conversation. I'm with several hundred, maybe a couple of thousand psychiatrists from all around the world at this conference, and it's the big thing on everybody's tongue at the moment, and particularly foreign psychiatrists who don't know that I'm Irish ask me, what do you think about Boris? What do you think about Brexit and all that? Yeah. And of course, I have to be honest and say it's not really my topic.
Absolutely.
And move away pretty quickly.
So people are talking about Boris Johnson and Jeremy Hunt, but are they talking about their policies, or are they talking about their personal lives?
They're just talking about them in general terms. It's not even at the level of policy or the level of gossip. They're just talking about them, what do you think of Boris? What do you think of Jeremy? It's mainly against the backdrop of Brexit, and Brexit is really the thing that's challenging people. And, most psychiatrists would be opposed to Brexit.
Sure.
And they're just concerned about Brexit and how will whoever gets elected handle it.
Yeah, the kind of phenomenon that is Brexit.
Exactly.
Yeah, so there are perhaps two schools of thought. One, that a person's personal life has nothing to do with their ability to govern, and another which says a flawed character is bound to make mistakes in their political responsibilities. As a psychiatrist, Patricia, where do you sit on that?
Well, I'm ambivalent in respect of the way you put the question.
Okay,
there.
Okay, good, yeah. Interrogate the question,
If somebody is likely to make errors of judgment because of their flawed character, then I don't want somebody like that. But if the person is a flawed person in their personal life and has affairs, but otherwise are good legislators, good parliamentarians, I don't actually mind about their personal life. So the key issue for me is, will they make errors of judgment? And remember, very stalwart people can make very bad errors of judgment.
Absolutely.
So it's whether people make errors of judgment is not just related to the affairs they have. It's related to their innate personality, and that is a key issue. But on the Boris issue, as long as he does okay as a legislator, I don't mind. And I think the hypocrisy of this is that it's being driven by politics. It's not that the commentariat who are writing in the newspapers are driven by a desire to protect the family or traditional values or anything like that.
Absolutely.
Purely driven by the fact that they don't want Brexit and they want to do everything they can to get rid of the strongest proponent of Brexit.
Yeah, I hear that. So what do you think of the scrutiny that Boris Johnson and others have been subjected to over the past weeks in that case?
Well, it's interesting because Boris Johnson is obviously being subjected to huge analysis by the media, but much less Jeremy Hunt. Now, I suspect that Jeremy Hunt has probably not much to scrutinise in there. I suspect he's quite a virtuous man given by some of the things he has said in the past. Jeremy Corbyn. I mean, I don't think he's any angel.
Sure.
And he might be, he might at some point in the future be a prime minister, but he has been subject to very little scrutiny. His personal life has been, and indeed his policies as well, but that's because the media really don't give a damn about the personal lives of people unless they don't like their politics, and they all like Jeremy Corbyn's politics.
Yeah, and I understand what you're saying, that there is something kind of duplicitous about, you know, if people are being attacked simply because of their stance towards or against Brexit, and this, of course, is the Conservative Party itself. It's not like the general British public, and they seem to be really, really excited about getting Brexit done. So they have to, you know, that there's, it does feel a little bit, as you say in your column, duplicitous. Could the likes of Boris Johnson, do you think, actually get a backlash of support because people are attacking his personal life rather than his policies?
I think he probably could. I mean, that's often the way, that when the attack becomes so personal and irrelevant to the issue in question, there could be a backlash. I suppose it depends on his competition, and if the competition, Jeremy Hunt, were regarded as being so strong and a real challenger, there might be a backlash in support of Boris. But if Boris is way ahead, that it doesn't matter. People always like an underdog, so there wouldn't be a backlash then against Boris.
Yeah, absolutely. So in that case, how do we assess our politicians? They're judged on their ability as politicians. Is that what we're saying?
Yes, I think so. And whether we like their policies or not, whether we as individuals like their overall policies. So how did they do as politicians? Have they made any huge errors? Are they themselves being hypocritical? Although I have some sympathy with hypocrisy, but if, for example, somebody is talking about the banker as being doing nefarious and illegal things, and yet they themselves have money stashed away in offshore accounts, that would be hypocritical. But on the other hand, we're all hypocrites. So
yeah,
I think
exactly,
the bottom line is, you know, we've been talking about climate change, but what politician isn't going to go abroad on holidays and make a huge carbon footprint in so doing simply because of climate change? They're not going to. And it's the same with all of the other climate change warriors. They're all going on holidays. They're all, you know, they all have the plastic water bottles. I mean,
yes.
it was amazing at Glastonbury this weekend. What's his name? David Attenborough spoke at it, and there were mountains of plastic bottles.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's hypocrisy, and I think we're all hypocrites. So they're doing a good job as politicians. They're doing the best they can to represent the people. Are they being honest in what they tell them about their policies, or are they leading us astray? And those kinds of issues.
The Best of the Morning Show.
There was a lovely good news story this week from the rubble of a conflict zone in northern Iraq. Miriam, a young girl who, along with all her neighbours, was driven from her village when ISIS invaded the Nineveh Plains in 2014. Then, just 9 years old, she told a TV network that she would pray for ISIS, that God would forgive them. And now, nearly 5 years on, she has been able to return to her home. I talked to David Turner, director of Irish charity Church in Chains, about Miriam and her story.
She and her family, and indeed many thousands of Christians, were driven from their home by Islamic State back in 2014. And, you know, it was a horror story. It was a story of Christians being killed. It was a story of ethnic cleansing. And, you know, it was greeted with horror all over the world. And then a few months later, SAT7, which is the Christian television channel that covers the whole Middle East region, they sent a reporter up to Iraqi Kurdistan, where the Christians had fled to. And he went around and he interviewed a whole pile of people. And one of the people he interviewed was a 9-year-old girl called Miriam. And that interview and one of her favourite Christian songs, which she sang in the course of that interview, just captured so many people's hearts, because she talked of her love for God. And when he asked her, he was just, he got down and was on his hunkers, kind of at her eye level, and said, how would she feel about the terrorists who'd driven her from her home? And she just very calmly said I will only ask God to forgive them.
Wow.
And, you know, it was something that really resonated with so many people because it was the power of forgiveness in the voice of a young Christian girl.
Amazing. And so young, like a nine-year-old or whatever she was, and she still had that powerful message of forgiveness in and through her. And in the middle of this, what was an absolute trauma, really, for her, to be able to turn around and say, that's so extraordinary, isn't it?
It is indeed, yes. And, you know, it's something really that we can't explain apart from the fact of, you know, the fact that when we're forgiven by God, he puts a heart of forgiveness in us. And that was expressed so clearly in the simple faith of young Christian girl.
I actually have a little card here with the original interview in it. I'm just going to play it for you now.
كان عندنا بيت وكنا متونسين بس يعني هنا ما متونسين بس الحمد لله يعني الله سترنا الله حبنا وما قبل يعني يقتلونا داعش.
انت حاسه باي ناحيه الناس اللي ممكن تبقى خرجتك من البيت وتعبتك؟
ما راح اسويهم ولا شيء بس يعني اقول لله يسامحهم.
So I'm just going to translate directly from that. Miriam, we had a home back in Karakosh and we were happy, but thank God that he provided for us. God protected us from ISIS so they won't kill us. And Sat7 interview says, what do you feel towards those who uprooted you from your homeland? Miriam, I will pray for them so that God would forgive them. It's just moving, isn't it?
It is, yes, it really is. And often it's just simple statements from a child that can often stop us in our tracks.
Surely can. So David, 5 years later, Miriam is now back living in her hometown.
Yes, indeed. People will have known from following deep coverage in the news that the Iraqi government forces forced Islamic State militants from that area. And that led to a situation where some of the Christians felt they would like to go home. I think all of them would like to go home, but there's an understandable fear as to whether there would be enough security for them. But Miriam and her family, they did go home, and they found that while most of their hometown had just been destroyed, amazingly their home remained standing. So just very recently, Sat7 went to see if they could track Miriam down again. And the original interviewer went on this trip, and he met with Miriam and her family. And Miriam is now 13 years old. And she told him in this interview, she said that she believed her family home was protected by the hand of God. That was her quote. But then she went on to say, it's not about the house. It's about seeing what God is doing for you. God is always protecting you, and you can count on him.
Okay, you know, I've actually got that little piece with me, so I'm just gonna play it for you now.
It's a very, very good thing because I back to my home. I see my home again. I'm living now in my home, so I can remember all the great memories I have I had before. Our house was protected by the hand of God. God is always with me.
Amazing. And in the meantime, she's learned English as well, as I can hear.
Yes, indeed. Obviously that would be an asset to her, I think, in the years ahead.
The Best of the Morning Show on Spirit Radio.
Thursday was the 4th of July, Independence Day in the United States, a day for Americans to celebrate their national identity. I talked to Bostonian and NUI Galway law lecturer Larry Donnelly about the United States, its strengths and challenges, and its role on the world stage. First, I asked Larry if he looked at America differently after years of living abroad.
Yeah, I suppose at one level you can't help but look differently, and sometimes perhaps a little bit askance at America. I mean, certainly in the United States, there is both in the education system and in popular culture, there are certain taglines that we accept almost unthinkingly, that America is the best country in the world, that America is the land of opportunity, that there's nowhere else like it, that just about anybody in the world would love to live in the United States. And I mean, to be honest, one of the things growing up in the Boston area, especially for me, and you mentioned the relationship between the U.S. and Ireland, growing up in the Boston area in the 80s and 90s, as I did, with the amount of Irish people who were there living, you know, the definite perception was that everyone in Ireland absolutely wanted to live in the U.S. and especially in Boston.
Sure, yeah. Yeah,
whereas things don't always meet that expectation. I think America is a wonderful country, but one that is politically divided, and there's been a lot of talk about that, but one that has some serious issues as well if you compare it to Western Europe. And I'm speaking particularly about two things. One is healthcare, which gets talked about an awful lot. And then the other thing that doesn't get talked about nearly enough, in my view, is the extraordinary cost of higher education in the United States vis-a-vis Western Europe. And one of the, if I was to say, to have one negative reflection on the United States, it just blows my mind that, for instance, where I went to college, the College of the Holy Cross, a Jesuit college, one of the most prestigious liberal arts colleges in the country and a great place, but it blows my mind that tuition, including room and board there for next year, will approach $70,000.
What?
And it's just extraordinary when you compare that with the excellent educations available in Irish universities. I'm biased towards NUI Galway, but the others as well, but at an absolute fraction of the cost. And if there was one thing above all the other issues, because I believe so strongly in education, if there's one thing that the United States needs to fix most urgently, perhaps, it is that access to third-level education, because it's gone beyond the beyond.
I mean, 70 grand is mad, isn't it?
It is, Matt, and you know what you hear about is you hear about you know, scholarships, and very few people actually pay the $70,000. And yes, there are some scholarships. There is you know, there is financial aid available, especially at elite institutions, that goes to people. So not everyone pays $70,000.
Sure,
but the vast majority of people take out significant loans that have to be repaid in order to access higher education. So you have a significant number of 21, 22-year-old young guys and girls coming out with liberal arts degrees in one hand, and in the other hand, $150,000 worth of debt or more, which is quite a handicap to start life with.
Yeah, that's huge. It's like it's getting towards mortgage, you know, level of debt. You know, and that idea of having been away from America for a number of years, as I know you have, the converse is also true. I suppose there are things that you probably appreciate more about America from being away from it.
There are certain things that, you know, when I go home, you know, I absolutely love. Some of them, to be frank, some of them are quite at a low level. You know, some things like food and other things.
Yeah, absolutely.
Irish people would miss when they go away.
For sure.
But also my friends and family. And the one thing is, you know, I'm in Ireland a long time now, as you know, almost 18 years. And I love the place. It's a place I have familial ties to as well. I have lots of relations who made my adjustment to living in Ireland very easy. But still, at the same time, you know, my accent will always set me apart. My upbringing, the experiences of my childhood, that means that the great friends I have in Ireland, and I, we have a lot in common, but we'll never have that stuff in common.
Absolutely.
And getting back to being with my friends and family and the people I grew up with when I go home to Boston, that's probably what I miss above all else, and that commonality of experience.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no doubt that you know, no matter how well you integrate, and no matter how much, and when I say well, you know what I mean, how there's always that part of you that belongs to the other place. You are away from home in a lot of ways, aren't you?
Absolutely. And you know, there's something to be said. Who among us hasn't done stupid stuff or made fools of ourselves or embarrassed ourselves, particularly when we're young and we're finding our feet and we're maturing and all that other stuff? And, you know, being back with people who knew you, no matter how seriously you might take yourself and take your career, but people who can really give you a good slap down when you come home, there's nothing like being brought back to earth. And I'd say a lot of Irish immigrants, when they come home and they start talking about what they might be doing in America or Canada or Australia, they come home and their friends very quickly remind them of the most embarrassing moments of their life and, you know, who they really are. And I think there's no substitute for that.
Yeah, absolutely. Going back to America and kind of its place in the world, and I know there's a lot of debate about that at the moment because it seems to be in a kind of flux. Well, you know, you mentioned the education part, and you also mentioned the fact that there is a kind of a division, which I in my lifetime, I've never seen anything quite like it. What do you feel are its greatest problems and challenges today?
Yeah, I think that there's a couple of things, but I think that to some extent, you know, the onward march of globalization and technology are at the heart of a lot of this, because what they have equally led to is a hollowing out of the middle in the United States, the middle class, the people who, I suppose, made good livings and could get by and provide for their families. Those numbers are shrinking, and increasingly we see those people being relegated to the margins because their buying power and all sorts of other things aren't what they used to be. And as a consequence, we see families that are separated and divided. We see all sorts of rates of opioid and other addictions that are really having devastating consequences. So we see an awful lot of people are struggling. And then we see a very small number at the top who are thriving and who are prospering. And we see both political parties, I think, ran from that reality for a long, long time. The Democrats moved very much to the cultural left and arguably abandoned some of the principles that would have always made them the party for people who work with their hands for a living and live paycheck to paycheck. While on the other hand, the Republicans embrace some of the uglier elements, I think, of the hard right, and again, for their own ideological reasons, didn't really do much for the plight of those people who were affected. Because the two parties ran and hid and buried their heads in the sand from all the stuff that's actually going on, that's what led the American people to take a real risk and a real gamble on President Donald Trump. And I think that that's what's led to some of the division that's so manifest in the country right now. And while 70%, I mean, an encouraging sign is 70% of the American people are still proud to be American, there is a very big debate in the United States about what it means to be an American. There are different versions of what that means. I think the country is going to be grappling with this for a while to come.
The Best of the Morning Show.
We had a special guest as our prayer coach this week, Bishop Fonzie Cullinan from Waterford and Lismore, and we had a tough topic for him, what it means to be a disciple of Jesus Christ. Bishop Fonzie started by saying why we can't avoid using the word disciple or replace it with another word.
The Lord says in Matthew chapter 28, you know, go and make disciples. So he wants his church, he wants his followers to make disciples, to make followers of him. People who will, it's the same word as discipline, actually. Yeah. And, you know, to commit to him. But isn't that a beautiful thing, really? To commit to Jesus. I mean, what better person could we commit our lives to? There isn't any.
I know what you mean, because we're very familiar now with the idea of friends. I mean, just think about, you know, Facebook and the rest.
Yes.
And followers, you know. So we know about follower, we know about friend.
Sure.
A disciple, something more, isn't it?
It's something more. There's a commitment there, that I commit myself to following this person. And that can be so countercultural, of course, you see, because commitment now is... I remember I saw a T-shirt, I'm not the commitment type, was written on it. And I said, oh dear, how sad. Who would like to be a friend of that person?
Yeah.
No one. Yeah, I mean, wouldn't you like your friend to commit to you and to be faithful and loyal? So, you know, in culture today, in our culture, there's so much talk about freedom, to be free, to follow my heart, whatever my heart dictates. But wait a minute, I mean, run on, I'm a sinner. If I follow whatever my heart dictates, I will end up being a slave to things which are not good, which are not going to make me fully be myself. You know, St. Paul has an extraordinary line, which is a real paradox. And of course, our Christian faith is full of paradoxes, where St. Paul says, and I paraphrase him, I become free in being a slave to Christ.
There it is, yeah.
I mean, isn't that? And, you know, like, you know, the Lord, there are so many of these paradoxes in what he says, you know. Blessed are the meek, they shall inherit the earth. But the wisdom of the world would be, blessed are the strong, because they'll dominate.
That's right, yeah.
But it's the complete opposite with Christ. So he is calling us to commit ourselves to him, and then he will make us free. You know, take up your cross, follow me, learn from me. I am gentle and humble in heart, you will find rest for your souls. Commit to me and to my truth, and the truth will set you free.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, it is amazing, and it's true. And, you know, the people that I meet who are truly free are the people who have given their lives over to God and to others, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, again, St. Francis this time, you know, that line which is so striking, you know, in one of his prayers, it is in giving that we receive. It's in giving away ourselves that we truly receive, and we really find out who we are, you know. And that's
so this kind of elusive thing, which is freedom that people are really getting after, and it's a basic human need to have freedom to be able to make decisions.
Sure,
but weirdly, it eludes us until we commit.
It does.
That's really what you're saying.
Yeah, that is true, because you see, we are flawed. We are flawed. So if I follow my freedom completely, because I am flawed, I will end up down a wrong road. But it's the Lord's grace that heals my sinfulness. And in Him, and following Him, I find true freedom and joy. And I'm sure, what could be better than that? And not only in this world, but He promises us eternal joy. Isn't that something worth?
Wonderful. Yeah, absolutely. Why wouldn't
committing
you do it?
One's life to?
Why wouldn't you do it? It's funny. I found this extraordinary quote from actually Friedrich Nietzsche of all people.
And
he described it as a long obedience in the same direction.
Wow.
And I thought that was really caught my mind. You know, a long obedience in the same direction.
Yes.
And actually, then if you get that, and he and I know he was very nihilistic and stuff, but still, even he recognized that you needed to do that.
That's right.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that he used the word obedience, because obedience actually ab audere means to listen to.
Oh,
you know.
Wow.
So if you really listen to what's going on in your life, and not just follow superficially, if you try to get underneath the superficiality and truly listen to the Spirit and listen to your own conscience, which is, of course, the aboriginal voice of God within each person, if we can truly listen to our conscience and to what God is saying to us through Scripture, through others. Others can be channels, of course, of God's grace, and are all the time. But if we're truly listening, then we can, you know, discover the voice that I should follow, the things that I should do to make me truly, truly free, you know. So there is a constant adventure there, you might say, you know, in trying to discover the truth. But doesn't the Lord say, you know, seek and you will find, knock and the door will be open to you, ask and you will receive. So to keep asking for that wisdom of the Lord to show me true freedom, to show me that it is in giving myself to God and to others that I truly become myself.
The Best of the Morning Show.
The GAA Championship is bubbling along nicely, and this weekend has plenty of interesting games in the football and hurling qualifiers. Yesterday, I talked to GAA analyst Cormac Cahill, who always has plenty to say about this weekend's games.
You've got Dublin, of course, in the qualifiers on Sunday as well. So what do you reckon there?
Yeah, well, I suppose Dublin will, with due respect to Laois, Dublin will most likely, I'm sure Laois will give him plenty of it for the first, we'll say, you know, half, maybe 40, 50 minutes. I would think that the gap between Joe McDonagh and the Liam McCarthy, that level, what hurling tends to do more so than football is that smaller gaps in talent can be exaggerated on the scoreboard. Yeah. You know, that whereas you could have, we say, a football team from a lower tier can quite often stay within touching distance of a better team because football just doesn't tend to have the higher scores. Whereas in hurling, the gaps are exaggerated on the scoreboard. So I would reckon Dublin will certainly get past Laois. Again, with your respect to Laois, they're going great guns under Andy Brennan. Joe McDonagh, you know, they had a big crowd up in Croke Park last week, even though the Joe McDonagh isn't getting the publicity I think it deserves. It was a fantastic day out for Laois, so their tails would be up. But I think it's probably beyond them to get past Dublin, and I would never rule out Dublin. Dublin have an amount of hurlers over the last number of years that they never had before. You know, it's now cool in Dublin to be seen with a hurley. You know, going back 15 years, you'd hardly see them. They'd be as rare as hen's teeth. Yeah. So they have plenty of players. Wouldn't rule them out at all. I think they're going to end up playing Tipperary in the quarterfinal, should they get past. And again, we can assume that they're going to get past Laois. Tip are on a downer at the moment. As I said, they're missing a couple of key players. Will their age profile come against them? I wouldn't back against Dublin getting to an All-Ireland semi-final at all. And again, when you get to that stage, all bets are off.
That's right. You never know what way it's going to go. Absolutely. So quickly, Cormac, we're kind of up against it on the clock here, but I do want to get to football before I let you go. I'm going to read you something from Donegal Boyle in yesterday's Irish Independent, and you can guess who I'm talking about. Yeah. They have held the nation in thrall through unquestionable defiance and questionable decisions. There has been internal strife and external praise, while drama follows them around like a loyal hound. Already this year, they have played in three different territories, requiring three different currencies, and just when they probably do, when they could probably do with a break, they are handed a do-or-die game against their biggest rival. So, Cormac, who might that be?
You just have to love Mayo. You genuinely have to love Mayo. I mean, I'm so looking forward to this. Mayo and Galway, like Galway are 7 wins in a row over them, the last league and championship.
Yeah.
Every logic would suggest that Mayo are a condemned man going to the gallows. Every bit of logic would suggest.
Yeah.
Like, they're missing Damar O'Connor's out, Matty Ruan is out, Lee Keegan is out, Galway Hill Phil is coming back from injury, Comer is probably, I would think he's going to start because he's playing, he's a fantastic player. Galway have better, those three inside forwards that they have, Walsh, Comer and Burke are just, you know, there's something special. Mayo really don't have that special inside forward line, but it's Mayo.
End of
conversation. Yeah, who knows what's going to happen? As I said, they're a man going to the gallows, but you just have to love this bunch. They're just special. They're special.
Never say die. It's extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
And of course, it's Galway and Mayo, which is even another, you know, that has resonances as well, you know.
There's a rivalry. There was a good number of years going back to, say, you know, 3-4 years ago where Mayo probably didn't even respect Galway. Maybe Galway just weren't at the same level as them. That has changed entirely. Galway had the Indian sign over them. Mayo struggled to break down Galway's defensive style. Typical of Mayo. Mayo love a chaotic game. An open, up and down, bit of lunacy. They get their scores from, we'd say, further out the pitch. That suits Mayo better, whereas Galway are more controlled, they're defensive, they're more rehearsed, so to speak. So, as I said, everything would point toward a Galway victory here, but like, their backs are against the wall. Mayo backs against the wall. Who knows what's going to happen? I'm so looking forward to this. And of course, Mayo, the talk is that Mayo didn't want to go for the toss, so insisted on a neutral venue, and off we go down to the Gaelic grounds, where, you know, Mayo have played a couple of times over the last few years. Galway haven't done so.
Right.
Give them a slight advantage from
absolutely.
From
so very, very finally, Cormac, what other games and football qualifiers are you interested in?
Well, I think the other big one is Cork and Laois, right? Because here are two teams that, like, you know, Cork are allegedly on a good run of form. They have good challenge matches. What really gladdened me about Cork, and I went down to the Munster final against Kerry, is that they went, like, sort of 5 or 6 points down after 10 or 15 minutes, and there's a few people around me thinking, here we go, massive malfunction, we're going to be beaten out the gate by 20 points. Cork stayed with them. They seem to have turned a corner with their mental resilience. They stuck with their game plan. They're playing a reasonably decent style of football. It's a little bit more traditional Cork, which means runs with the ball. You know, they're just hitting their heads off Brocks and keep going forward. So it really gladdened, as I said, to me, to an awful lot of Cork supporters, say, hang on a second, we didn't just lay down here and die. We stuck at it. We came at them and we were still well in the game. But Laois are no mugs. You know, you mentioned Shukru, the Kerry man that's in charge of them. He's brought them from Division 4 to Division 2. He's got them to the last 12 over the last couple of years. Laois are a decent side. They're a good, decent side. And it's a real 50-50 game.
So could you call it, Cormac?
Cork with a slight edge, but only very slight. It would not surprise me one bit that Laois would get past that. We kind of still don't quite trust the Cork footballers. You know, there's a little bit of, you know, here we go again, lads. But you just
keep letting you down.
Yeah, there's trepidation there, but I just have a notion that they seem to have turned a corner with regard to their consistency. And because of that, a tentative nod to Cork.
The Best of the Morning Show on Spirit Radio.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.